2. The Post-Constitutional Era. Black milk of daybreak, we drink it at dusk, we drink it at noon, and at dawn we drink it. At night we drink it, and drink it, we are digging a grave in the air. Paul Celan, Death Fugue. Lynn Stewart, with short-cropped gray hair and a dark zippered fleece jacket, sat with her hands folded in front of her at her son's dining room table in Brooklyn, New York. She had been released from a Texas prison 37 days earlier because she had stage 4 cancer and had been given 6 months to live. She had served 4 years of a 10-year sentence. As an attorney, Stewart stood up to state power for more than 3 decades. She defended the poor, the persecuted, and the marginalized. She wept in court when one of her clients, Omar Abdel Rahman, was barred from presenting a credible defense. But at the end of her life, she was on trial herself, disbarred and imprisoned. Her career coincided with the collapse of the American court system and the rise of the post-constitutional era, in which the courts are used to revoke the constitutional rights of citizens by judicial fiat. Can't even work in a law office, the 74-year-old Stewart said when we spoke. I miss it so terribly. I liked it. I liked the work. When she started practicing law in the 1970s, she said it was a golden era in which a series of legal decisions, including rulings that affected police lineups and the information and evidence that the government had to turn over to defendants on trial, created a chance for a fair defense. But these legal advances were steadily reversed, she said, in a string of court decisions that, especially after 9/11, made the state omnipotent. As citizens were stripped of power, she said, the bar experienced a death of the spirit. Lawyers gave up. They no longer saw defending people accused of crime as a calling, something that you did because you were answering a higher voice. Stewart, working with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark and lawyer Abdin Jabara in 1995, was the lead trial counsel for Omar Abdel Rahman, an Egyptian Muslim known as the Blind Sheikh, who was convicted for alleged involvement in an aborted bombing campaign in New York City. He received life in prison plus 65 years in 1996 for seditious conspiracy, a sentence Stewart called outlandish. She said that Abdel Rahman was put on trial not for any crimes he committed, but because both Washington and the Egyptian government of Hosni Mubarak were frightened by his influence over the Egyptian population. The United States, along with Egypt, wanted to take him off the scene and get him put away where he would no longer exert the influence he had. The cleric, 76 and in poor health, is imprisoned in the medical wing of the Butner Federal Correctional Complex in North Carolina. The proceedings at the Abdel Rahman trial were a harbinger of the judicial assaults against Muslims in the United States after the events of September 11, 2001. I was based in Egypt as the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times when Abdel Rahman was arrested. I was stunned at the repeated mendacity of the government prosecutors who blamed Abdel Rahman for terrorist attacks he had publicly denounced. The prosecutors, for example, accused him of orchestrating the killing of 70 people in 1997 in Luxor, Egypt, although the Sheikh at the time condemned the attack and had no known connection with the Egyptian group that carried out the massacre. When the guilty verdict was read, Stewart burst into tears. The only time I ever cried in the courtroom. Stewart continued to visit the Sheikh after the sentencing. 3 years after the trial, the government severely curtailed his ability to communicate with the outside world, even through his lawyers, under special administrative measures, SAMs. Abdel Rahman asked Stewart during a prison visit in 2000 to release a statement from him to the press concerning a negotiated ceasefire between the Egyptian government and militants. The Clinton administration did not prosecute Stewart for conveying the press release, although she was admonished and prohibited from seeing her client for several months. The Bush administration, however, in April 2002, with a country baying for blood after the attacks of 9/11, decided to prosecute her for the 2-year-old press release. Minutes before her arrest on April 9, 2002, her husband, Ralph Poynter, who later would organize the successful fight to win her a compassionate release from prison after she was diagnosed with breast cancer, was outside on the stoop of their house, which in New York, she said, is where you go sit on the steps in the summertime when you can't afford to go to East Hampton. She heard him in a heated conversation. I go to the door and I hear him saying, I don't see any badge, I don't see any warrant, what are you doing here anyway? She said. Assuming Ralph was being arrested, she told him to take it easy, she would have him home by lunchtime. I come around the door, and the guy looks and says, and he was clearly a cop, you know, the cheap shoes, and he says, we're not here for you, we're here for her, pointing to me, she said. I was flabbergasted. The FBI agents arrested her. She was released later on a $500,000 bond. U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft came to New York in April 2002 to announce the arrest and appear on The Late Show with David Letterman. He told the television audience that the Justice Department had indicted Stewart, along with a paralegal and an interpreter, on grounds of materially aiding a terrorist organization. The government demanded that Stewart be given a staggering 30-year sentence. During the trial, the government lawyers spewed endless myths about Islamic terrorism. The prosecutors displayed on a 10-by-12-foot screen a photo of Osama bin Laden found in a co-defendant's basement. The U.S. District Judge John Codal repeatedly told the jury that the photo of bin Laden wasn't evidence of the truth of the charges. Stewart was sentenced, to most people's astonishment, to 28 months. After the sentencing, Stewart publicly declared that passing along the information from Abdelrahman had been based on my understanding of what the client needed, what a lawyer was expected to do. It had been necessary, she said, adding that in the same circumstances, she would do it again. A federal appeals court under the Barack Obama administration demanded that the district judge reconsider Stewart's sentence and make further fact findings. She was given a new sentence by Codal, 10 years. The federal government's heavy-handed orchestration of fear, Stewart said, has cowed the nation. In the Carswell Federal Prison in Texas, the women's facility where she was incarcerated, she heard numerous accounts of gross injustices endured by poor women. She frequently asked these women why they had not demanded a trial rather than submit to a plea deal, or why they had not stood up and proclaimed their innocence. The answer, she said, was always the same. I was afraid. I was afraid. The right-wing Federalist Society, after its founding in 1982, unleashed a frontal assault on the legal system that has transformed it into a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state. After Stanford University asked Stewart to speak there in 2002, she arrived on campus to find that the Federalist Society had pressured the university into rescinding the invitation. Sympathetic students found her a place to talk, but Federalist Society members appeared at the event to jeer and ask caustic questions. By the 1980s, she said, the federal government was mopping up the remnants of radical activists, many of whom had been underground for years. She and other civil rights attorneys were able to battle on behalf of these political radicals, but by the end of the 1980s, the state had finished its hunt for underground activists, and lawyers, Stewart said, were no longer part of the game. The occasional victories that she and other civil rights lawyers were able to win before the attacks of 9/11 became nearly impossible to replicate afterward. The playing field suddenly changed, and everything favored the prosecution, certainly in federal cases, she said. There was no level playing field anymore. It was like if you were the last guy standing and you had to keep them from making the goal. You were at the 6-inch line trying to do it. It was impossible to stop them. They controlled it. They controlled what the charges were. They controlled whether an adjournment would be given. They determined whether the cooperation is worthy, and everybody must cooperate. And it changed into a very different system, certainly on the federal level. In her own trial, the government presented audio recordings of her meetings with Abdelrahman in the prison in Rochester, Minnesota. The taping of that conversation before the Federal Patriot Act would have violated attorney-client privilege, but now such tapings are legal. We continue the facade that we are fair, she said. that we have this constitution we respect and we can rely on and that we can embrace. You can't do that. That's my constitutional rights, etc. When really, our constitutional rights are a puff of smoke. They don't really exist. She began to reflect on the cost of being imprisoned, something she said she had not fully understood until she was locked up. I don't think I ever appreciated the unrelenting stress, she said about being in prison, that you're always waiting for something to come down, that there's such arbitrary authority. Guard A says, go down those stairs, use the stairs. Guard B says, you can't use the stairs, you're not permitted on the stairs. And you say, but Guard A just said, I don't care what he said, this is my rule. That kind of arbitrary thing, you're always guessing. What does this guy, what does this woman want me to do? Where am I? Where is this? And that's 24/7. You're always on the cusp of doing the wrong thing or getting in trouble for something, she said. I wrote a letter for a woman, and in order to make a copy, I emailed it to Ralph. She went on, it was basically asking a judge to stay any decision because they were going to take all of her pension as payment for what she had done, and she wanted to get this letter in right away. So I emailed it to Ralph, and for that I lost, I think, about 3 months of commissary and email. I found it virtually impossible to convince the women at Carswell that they should not be always thinking that what happened to them was personal, she said. They should be looking at political answers, that where they ended up was not because of some personal lack or weakness, but because the political system has designated them to be there as one of the kick-arounds, as one of the not-for-consumption. One of the saddest moments in prison was mail call. The names of those who had letters would be read. Some women waited for their name to be called, and it never happened. Those who did not get mail or visits, Stewart said, become more and more institutionalized. The world of the prison is the only world. The outside world does not exist for them anymore. She no longer believes the working class has the ability or consciousness to revolt. I'm not waiting for the working class to make the revolution, she said. I think that's a day long gone by. That might have happened in the 30s. It didn't. We have to look at a new way, some new force. But at the same time, she wants people to prepare. The most important thing is, don't let yourself get isolated, she said. Don't feel that you're the only one in the room that thinks this way and you must be crazy or something, and they're going to get you because you're the only one. Find the other people who think like you. They're out there. There are people out there. There are groups. There's everyone from the raging grannies right up to the very serious lefties. But there's somebody out there. Make sure you're not all alone. That's the worst part of what we face these days. As long as you're with other people, you have a fighting chance, and you can organize more people. This is a pretty loveless world we live in, she concluded. We have lots of romantic love. We have lots of sex in the city. But real love, love that is the kind that saves people and makes the world better and makes you go to bed with a smile on your face, that love is lacking greatly. You have to search for that. The courts were perhaps the last institution that liberal reformers had faith in before they too fell victim to the demands of corporate power. There are no institutions left that provide the citizen with a voice. My own dead end with the judicial system occurred in April 2014 when the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear Hedges v. Obama, the lawsuit I brought against Barack Obama concerning Section 1021b2 of the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA. This provision permits the military to seize U.S. citizens and hold them indefinitely in military detention centers without due process. The refusal by the Supreme Court to hear the case means that extraordinary rendition by our government of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil is legal. It means that the courts, like the legislative and executive branches of government, are now exclusive servants of corporate power. It means that the consent of the governed, in a poll conducted by OpenCongress.com, the NDAA provision had a 97% disapproval rating, is a cruel joke. And it means that if we do not rapidly build militant mass movements to overthrow corporate tyranny, including breaking the back of the two-party duopoly that is the mask of corporate power, we will lose what remains of our liberty. The attorneys Bruce Afrin and Carl Mayer and I had brought the case to the U.S. Southern District Court of New York in January 2012. I was later joined by co-plaintiffs, the philosopher and linguist Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, the journalist Alexa O'Brien, activist Tangerine Bolin, Icelandic parliamentarian Birgitta Jonsdottir, and Occupy activist Kai Wargala. U.S. District Judge Catherine B. Forrest in 2012 declared Section 1021(b)(2) unconstitutional. The Obama administration not only appealed, we expected it to appeal, but demanded that the law be immediately put back into effect until the appeal was heard. Forrest, displaying the same judicial courage she showed with her ruling, refused to do this. The government swiftly went to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. It asked, in the name of national security, that the court stay the district court's injunction until the government's appeal could be heard. The Second Circuit agreed. The law went back on the books. Afrin, Mayer, and I surmised that the administration acted this quickly because it was already using the law to detain U.S. citizens in black sites, most likely dual citizens with roots in countries such as Pakistan, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Yemen. The administration would have been in contempt of court if Forrest's ruling had been allowed to stand while the federal authorities detained U.S. citizens under the statute. Government attorneys, when asked by Judge Forrest, refused to say whether or not the government was already using the law, buttressing our suspicion that it was in use. The Second Circuit overturned Forrest's ruling in July 2013 in a decision that did not force it to rule on the actual constitutionality of Section 1021(b)(2). It cited the Supreme Court ruling in Clapper v. Amnesty International, another case in which I was a plaintiff, to say that I had no standing or right to bring the NDAA case to court. Clapper v. Amnesty International had challenged the secret wiretapping of U.S. citizens under the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. The Supreme Court had ruled in Clapper that our concern about government surveillance was speculation. It said that we were required to prove to the court that the FISA Act would be used to monitor those we interviewed. The court knew, of course, that the government does not disclose whom it is monitoring, and it knew we could not offer proof. The documentation proving that we, and nearly all Americans, are victims of government surveillance had not yet been provided to the press by Edward Snowden. Snowden, who worked for the consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton at a national security agency, NSA, center in Hawaii, fled the country before leaking thousands of classified documents that detailed the massive government surveillance operation within the United States and abroad. The Second Circuit used the spurious Supreme Court ruling to make its own spurious ruling. It said that because we could not show that the indefinite detention law was about to be used against us, just as we could not prove government monitoring of our communications, we could not challenge the law. It was a dirty game of judicial avoidance on two egregious violations of the Constitution. In refusing to hear our lawsuit, the courts have overturned nearly 150 years of case law that repeatedly holds that the military has no jurisdiction over civilians. Now, a U.S. citizen charged by the government with substantially supporting al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or those in the nebulous category of associated forces, some of the language of Section 1021(b)(2), is lawfully subject to extraordinary rendition on U.S. soil. And those seized and placed in military jails can be kept there until the end of hostilities. Judge Forrest, in her 112-page ruling against the section, noted that under this provision of the NDAA, whole categories of Americans could be subject to seizure by the military. These might include Muslims, activists, black bloc anarchists, so named because they dress in black, obscure their faces, move as a unified mass, seek physical confrontations with police, and destroy property, and any other Americans labeled as domestic terrorists by the state. Forrest wrote that Section 1021(b)(2) echoed the 1944 Supreme Court ruling in Korematsu v. United States, which supported the government's use of the military to detain at least 110,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps without due process during World War II. When a citizenry no longer feels it can find justice through the organs of power, when it feels that the organs of power are the enemies of freedom and economic advancement, it makes war on those organs. Those of us who are condemned as radicals, idealists, and dreamers call for basic reforms that, if enacted, would make peaceful reform possible. But corporate capitalists, now unchecked by state power and dismissive of the popular will, do not see the fires they are igniting. The Supreme Court ruling on our challenge, like the imprisonment of Lynn Stewart, is one more signpost on the road to revolt. The longer citizens are locked out of and abused by systems of power, the more these systems become targets. Section 1021(b)(2) is but one piece of the legal tyranny now in place, along with our wholesale surveillance to ensure total corporate control. The state can order the assassination of U.S. citizens. It has abolished habeas corpus. It uses secret evidence to imprison dissidents, such as the Palestinian academic Mazen al-Najjar. It employs the Espionage Act to criminalize those who expose abuses of power. A ruling elite that accrues for itself this kind of total power, history has shown, eventually uses it. And at that point, we cement into place a brutal corporate totalitarianism. The cornerstone of control is the state's system of surveillance, exposed by Snowden. I saw the effect of blanket surveillance as a reporter in the Stasi state of communist East Germany. I was followed by men, invariably with crew cuts and leather jackets, whom I presumed to be agents of the Stasi, the Ministry for State Security, which the ruling Communist Party described as the shield and sword of the nation. Stasi agents visited those I interviewed soon after I left their homes. My phone was bugged. Some of those I worked with were pressured to become informants. Fear hung like icicles over every conversation. People would whisper to me to convey the most banal pieces of information. The Stasi did not set up massive death camps and gulags. It did not have to. Its network of as many as 2 million informants in a country of 17 million was everywhere. There were 102,000 secret police officers employed full-time to monitor the population, one for every 166 East Germans. The Nazis broke bones. The Stasi broke souls. The East German security apparatus pioneered the psychological disintegration skills that torturers and interrogators in America's black sites and within our prison system have honed to a chilling perfection. The goal of wholesale surveillance, as Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism, is not in the end to discover crimes, but to be on hand when the government decides to arrest a certain category of the population. This is what happened to Stewart. And because Americans' emails, phone conversations, web searches, and geographical movements are recorded and stored in perpetuity in government databases, there will be more than enough evidence to seize us should the state deem it necessary. This information waits like a dormant virus inside government vaults to be released against us. It does not matter how trivial or innocent that information is. In totalitarian states, justice, like truth, is irrelevant. Any state that has the capacity to monitor all its citizenry, any state that has the ability to snuff out factual public debate through the control of information, any state that has the tools to instantly shut down all dissent, is totalitarian. The state may not use this power today, but it will use it if it feels threatened. Those who sweep up all of our financial data, our tweets, our file transfers, our live chats, our medical data, our criminal and civil court records, those awash in billions upon billions of taxpayer dollars, those who have banks of sophisticated computer systems, along with biosensors, scanners, face recognition technologies, and miniature drones, are those who have obliterated our anonymity, our privacy, and our liberty. no one who lives under constant surveillance, who is subject to detention anywhere at any time, whose conversations, proclivities, and habits are recorded, stored, and analyzed, can be described as free. This is the relationship of masters and slaves. Yet the state assures us that our rights are sacred, that government abides by the will of the people and the consent of the governed, that our right to privacy is protected. And so begins the surrealist nightmare that writers such as Bulkakov and Roth have chronicled. The vast distance between perceived reality and the official version of reality is characteristic of totalitarian systems. The state abolishes liberty and rights while claiming to uphold and defend them. The most effective tyranny, as Arendt points out in The Origins of Totalitarianism, crushes its marginalized and harassed opponents and, through fear and the obliteration of privacy, incapacitates everyone else. The object of efficient totalitarian states, as George Orwell understood, is to create a climate in which people do not think of rebelling, a climate in which incarceration and state-sanctioned murder are used against only a handful of unmanageable renegades. The totalitarian state achieves this control, Arendt wrote, by systematically shutting down all human spontaneity, and by extension, human freedom, through fear. This fear and loss of spontaneity keep a population traumatized and immobilized and turn the courts, along with legislative bodies, into mechanisms that legalize the crimes of state. This legal sleight of hand is how our most basic constitutional rights have been obliterated. The Fourth and Fifth Amendments of the Constitution, which were established to protect us from unwarranted intrusion by the government into our private lives, may still technically be law, but they have been judicially abolished. The Fourth Amendment was written in 1789 in direct response to the arbitrary and unchecked search powers that the British had exercised through general warrants called writs of assistance, which played a significant part in fomenting the American Revolution. The amendment limits the state's ability to search and seize to a specific place, time, and event approved by a magistrate. It is impossible to square the bluntness of the Fourth Amendment with the arbitrary search and seizure of all our personal communications. The courts and legislative bodies of the corporate state now routinely invert our most basic rights to justify corporate pillage and repression. They declare that massive and secret campaign donations, a form of legalized bribery, are protected speech under the First Amendment. They define corporate lobbying, under which corporations lavish funds on elected officials and write our legislation, as the people's right to petition the government. And according to new laws and legislation, we can be tortured or assassinated or locked up indefinitely by the military, be denied due process, and be spied upon without warrants. The U.S. Constitution has not been rewritten, but steadily emasculated through a dirty system of judicial and legislative reinterpretation. We have been left with a fictitious shell of democracy and a totalitarian core. Once the state has the power to intrude into the private lives of its citizens, it becomes omnipresent. It listens and collects everything, no matter how arcane or trivial. The NSA bugged the conclave that elected the new pope. It bugged the phone of the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, and in fact, it has bugged most of the leaders of Europe. It intercepted the talking points of UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon ahead of a meeting with President Obama. It bugged businesses like the Brazilian oil company Petrobras and acquired information regarding American law firms engaged in trade deals with Indochina for shrimp and clove cigarettes. The NSA, in conjunction with Australian intelligence, carried out a major eavesdropping effort focused on the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Bali in 2007. NSA officials also bugged their own ex-lovers, wives, and girlfriends. A technical system of surveillance designed to monitor those considered to be a danger to the state has been turned against you, in the words of the NSA whistleblower William Binney. Thomas Paine described despotic government as a fungus growing out of a corrupt civil society. This is what has happened to us. But our corporate totalitarian rulers deceive themselves as often as they deceive the public. Politics for them is public relations. Lies are not told to achieve any discernible goal of public policy, but to protect the image of the state and its rulers. These lies have become a grotesque form of patriotism. James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, lied under oath to Congress about the pervasive state surveillance of the citizenry. This spectacle was a rare glimpse into the absurdist theater that now characterizes American political life. A congressional oversight committee holds public hearings. It is lied to. It knows it is being lied to. The person who lies knows the committee members know he is lying, and the committee members, to protect their security clearances, say and do nothing. The state's ability, through comprehensive surveillance, to prevent outside inquiry into the exercise of power engenders a terrifying intellectual and moral sclerosis within the ruling elite. Absurd notions, such as implanting democracy in Baghdad by force in order to spread it across the region, or terrorizing radical Islam into submission, are no longer checked by reality, experience, or factually grounded debate. Data and facts that do not fit into the whimsical theories of our political elites, generals, and intelligence chiefs are ignored and hidden from public view. The citizenry cannot take self-corrective measures because it is denied factual information. And when the unchallenged elites soon come to believe their own lies, the state descends into dysfunction, terror, and burlesque. Totalitarian states use propaganda to orchestrate historical amnesia, a state-induced stupidity. The object is to make sure the populace does not remember what it means to be free. And once a population does not remember what it means to be free, it does not react when freedom is stripped from it. The tightening of the corporate totalitarian noose would have continued without legal or public debate if Edward Snowden had not jolted the nation awake. Snowden revealed, through his leaks of NSA documents, evidence of what former Vice President Al Gore said appears to be crimes against the U.S. Constitution. Snowden's revelations triggered for the first time a genuine discussion about mass surveillance. Two judges finally passed rulings on the NSA's surveillance program. U.S. District Judge Richard J. Leon, in December 2013, ruled that the bulk collection of metadata probably violates the Fourth Amendment relating to unreasonable searches and seizures and is almost Orwellian in its sweep. The Justice Department appealed Judge Leon's ruling. U.S. District Judge William Pauley later that month reversed Judge Leon's decision to rule that the National Security Agency's bulk collection of telephone records is legal. A presidential panel criticized the agency's blanket surveillance and called for reform. A New York Times editorial on January 1, 2014, argued that Snowden's revelations had done the country a great service and called for some form of clemency that would allow him to return home. The editorial listed some of the crimes of government that Snowden had exposed. The NSA broke federal privacy laws or exceeded its authority thousands of times per year, according to the agency's own internal auditor. The agency broke into the communication links of major data centers around the world and spied on hundreds of millions of user accounts, infuriating the internet companies that own the centers. Many of those companies are now scrambling to install systems that the NSA cannot yet penetrate. The NSA systematically undermined the basic encryption systems of the internet, making it impossible to know whether sensitive banking and medical data is truly private and damaging businesses that depend on this trust. James Clapper, Jr., the director of National Intelligence, lied to Congress when he testified in March 2013 that the NSA was not collecting data on millions of Americans. There has been no discussion of punishment for that lie. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court rebuked the NSA for repeatedly providing misleading information about its surveillance practices, according to a ruling made public because of the Snowden documents. One of the practices violated the Constitution, according to the chief judge of the court. A federal district judge ruled in December 2013 that the phone records collection program probably violates the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. He called the program almost Orwellian and said there was no evidence that it had stopped any imminent act of terror. Before Snowden, we were not even able to get a hearing in court. Some members of Congress, although that body authorized the Patriot Act and its Section 215, which ostensibly permits this wholesale surveillance of the public, expressed dismay at the extent of the NSA's activities and the weakness of its promised reforms. Maybe they are lying, maybe they are not. Maybe reforms will produce improvements, or maybe, as appears to be happening, they will be merely cosmetic. But before Snowden, we had nothing. Snowden's revelations made us conscious. To rebel requires that elusive virtue that Snowden exemplifies and that Melville Starbuck lacks, moral courage. I have been to war. I have seen physical courage. But this kind of courage is not moral courage. Very few of even the bravest warriors have moral courage. The person with moral courage defies the crowd, stands up as a solitary individual, shuns the intoxicating embrace of comradeship, and is disobedient to authority, even at the risk of his or her life, for a higher principle. And with moral courage comes persecution. The U.S. Army pilot Hugh Thompson had moral courage. He landed his helicopter between a platoon of U.S. soldiers and 10 terrified Vietnamese civilians during the My Lai massacre in 1968. He ordered his gunner to fire his M60 machine gun on the advancing U.S. soldiers if they began to shoot the villagers. And for this act of moral courage, Thompson was hounded and reviled. Moral courage always looks like this. It is always defined by the state as treason. The Army attempted to cover up the massacre and threatened to court-martial Thompson. Moral courage is the courage to act and to speak the truth. Thompson had it. Daniel Ellsberg had it. Martin Luther King Jr. had it. What those in authority once said about them, they say today about Snowden. We who have been fighting against mass state surveillance for years have made no headway by appealing to the traditional centers of power. It was only after Snowden methodically leaked documents disclosing the crimes committed by the state that genuine public debate began. Elected officials for the first time promised reform. None of this would have happened, none of it, without Snowden. His critics argue that he could have reformed the system from the inside. He could have gone to his superiors or Congress or the courts. But Snowden had numerous examples, including the persecution of the NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake, who originally tried to go through so-called proper channels to remind him that working within the system is fatal. Drake attempted to alert Congress and his superiors about waste, mismanagement, and possible constitutional violations at the NSA, but was repeatedly rebuffed. He eventually provided information, none of it classified, to a reporter at the Baltimore Sun who was investigating a bungled $1.2 billion surveillance program called Trailblazer. Drake was charged by the government under the Espionage Act and faced up to 35 years imprisonment. When the government's case collapsed in court, Drake was able to plead to one misdemeanor count for exceeding authorized use of a computer. Snowden had watched as senior officials, including Obama, lied to the public about internal surveillance. He knew that the president was willfully dishonest when he assured Americans that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which meets in secret and hears only from the government, is transparent. He knew that the president's statement that Congress was overseeing the entire program was false. He knew that everything Director of National Intelligence James Clapper told the press, the Congress, and the public about the surveillance of Americans was a lie. Snowden had access to the full roster of everyone working at the NSA. He could have made public the entire intelligence community and undercover assets worldwide. He could have exposed the locations of every clandestine station and their missions. He could have shut down the surveillance system, as he has said, in an afternoon. But this was never his intention. He wanted only to halt the wholesale surveillance that was being carried out until he documented it without our consent or knowledge. He knew that the information he possessed could be made available to the public only through a few journalists whose integrity he could trust. There is no free press without the ability of reporters to protect the confidentiality of those who have the moral courage to make public the abuse of power. If we do not immediately dismantle the security and surveillance apparatus, there will be no investigative journalism or judicial oversight to address abuses of power. There will be no organized dissent. There will be no independent thought. Criticisms, however tepid, will be treated as acts of subversion. Snowden had no choice, just as we now have no choice. He defied the formal institutions of government because they do not work, and all who seek reform must follow his example. Appealing to the judicial, legislative, or executive branches of government in the hope of reform is as realistic as accepting the offer made by the March Hare during the Mad Tea Party in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. "Have some wine," the March Hare said in an encouraging tone. Alice looked all round the table, but there was nothing on it but tea. "I don't see any wine," she remarked. "There isn't any," said the March Hare. The public's inability to grasp the pathology of our oligarchic corporate elite makes it difficult to organize effective resistance. Compliant politicians, entertainers, and our vapid corporate-funded popular culture and news media hold up the elites as leaders to emulate. We are repeatedly assured that through diligence and hard work, we can join them. We are taught to equate wealth with success. This narrative keeps us from seeing the truth. "The rich are different from us," F. Scott Fitzgerald is said to have remarked to Ernest Hemingway, to which Hemingway allegedly replied, "Yes, they have more money." The exchange, although it never took place, does sum up a wisdom Fitzgerald had that eluded Hemingway. The rich are different. The cocoon of wealth and privilege permits the rich to turn those around them into compliant and expendable workers, hangers-on, servants, and sycophants. Wealth, as Fitzgerald illustrated in his 1925 novel The Great Gatsby, a tome on the depravity of the rich in the giddy world of speculation that would lead to the Depression, as well as his short story The Rich Boy, which appeared a year later, breeds a class of people for whom human beings are disposable commodities. Colleagues, business partners, clients, associates, shareholders, investors, employees, kitchen staff, servants, gardeners, tutors, personal trainers, even friends and family bend to the whims of the wealthy or disappear. Once oligarchs achieve unchecked economic and political power, as they have in the United States, the citizens too become disposable. And that, in the eyes of the elite, is what we are. "Let me tell you about the very rich," Fitzgerald writes in The Rich Boy. "They are different from you and me. They possess and enjoy early, and it does something to them, makes them soft where we are hard, and cynical where we are trustful, in a way that unless you were born rich, it is very difficult to understand. They think deep in their hearts that they are better than we are, because we had to discover the compensations and refuges of life for ourselves. Even when they enter deep into our world or sink below us, they still think that they are better than we are. They are different." Aristotle, who saw extreme inequality as the fundamental cause of revolution, argues in Politics that the rise of an oligarchic state leads to one of two scenarios. The impoverished underclass can revolt and overthrow the oligarchs to rectify the imbalance of wealth and power, or it can submit to the tyranny of oligarchic rule. The public face of the oligarchic class is carefully crafted by publicists and a compliant media. It bears little resemblance to the private face. This is hard for those who have not been admitted into the intimate circles of the elite to grasp. I, like Fitzgerald, was thrown into the embrace of the upper crust as a boy. I was sent to an exclusive New England boarding school at the age of 10 as a scholarship student. I had classmates whose fathers they rarely saw otherwise, arrived at the school in their limousines, accompanied by personal photographers, and at times their mistresses, so the press could be fed images of rich and famous men playing the role of dutiful dads. I spent time in the mansions of the ultra-rich and powerful, watching my classmates, who were children, callously order around men and women who worked as their chauffeurs, cooks, nannies, and servants. When the sons and daughters of the rich get into serious trouble, there are always lawyers, publicists, and political personages to protect them. George W. Bush's life is a case study in the insidious affirmative action for the rich. The rich have a disdain for the poor, despite carefully publicized acts of philanthropy, and a haughty dislike of the middle class. The lower classes are viewed as uncouth parasites, annoyances to be endured, sometimes placated, and always controlled in the quest to amass more power and money. My hatred of authority, along with my loathing for the pretensions, heartlessness, and sense of entitlement of the rich, comes from living among the privileged. It was a deeply unpleasant experience. I returned on summer breaks to the small town in Maine where my grandparents and relatives lived. They had more innate intelligence than most of my prep school classmates. I knew from a young age who my enemies were. They were careless people, Tom and Daisy, Fitzgerald writes of the wealthy couple at the center of Gatsby's life. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess they had made. Those who have too much of the goods of fortune, strength, wealth, friends, and the like are neither willing nor able to submit to authority, Aristotle writes in Politics. The evil begins at home. For when they are boys, by reason of the luxury in which they are brought up, they never learn, even at school, the habit of obedience. Oligarchs, as Aristotle, Machiavelli, Alexis de Tocqueville, Adam Smith, and Karl Marx knew, are schooled in the mechanisms of manipulation, subtle and overt repression and exploitation to protect their wealth and power. Foremost among their mechanisms of control is the control of ideas. Ruling elites ensure that the established intellectual class is subservient to an ideology, in this case, neoliberalism and globalization, that conveniently justifies their greed. The ruling ideas are nothing more than the ideal expression of the dominant material relationships, Marx wrote, the dominant material relationships grasped as ideas. The blanket dissemination of the ideology of neoliberalism through the media and the purging, especially in academia, of critical voices have permitted our oligarchs to orchestrate the industrial world's largest income inequality gap. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, in a May 2011 article titled "Of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%" in Vanity Fair, warned of the damage caused by the extreme concentration of wealth in the hands of an oligarchic elite. In our democracy, 1% of the people take nearly a quarter of the nation's income, he writes. In terms of wealth, rather than income, the top 1% control 40%. As a result, the top 1% have the best houses, the best educations, the best doctors, and the best lifestyles. But there is one thing that money doesn't seem to have bought, an understanding that their fate is bound up with how the other 99% live. Throughout history, this is something that the top 1% eventually do learn. Too late. For every $1 that the wealthiest 0.1% amassed in 1980, they had an additional $3 in yearly income in 2008. David K. Johnston explains in his article, "Nine Things the Rich Don't Want You to Know About Taxes." In the same period, the bottom 90%, Johnston says, added only 1 cent. Nearly half of the country is now classified as poor or low income. The real value of the minimum wage has fallen by $3.44 since 1968. Oligarchs do not believe in self-sacrifice for the common good. They never have, they never will. And now that they have full control of the economy and the legal system, as well as the legislative and executive branches of government, along with our media outlets, they use power as a blunt instrument for personal enrichment and domination. We Americans are not usually thought to be a submissive people, but of course we are, Wendell Berry writes. Why else would we allow our country to be destroyed? Why else would we be rewarding its destroyers? Why else would we all, by proxies we have given to greedy corporations and corrupt politicians, be participating in its destruction? Most of us are still too sane to piss in our own cistern, but we allow others to do so and we reward them for it. We reward them so well, in fact, that those who piss in our cistern are wealthier than the rest of us. How do we submit? By not being radical enough, or by not being thorough enough, which is the same thing. The ancient Greeks and Egyptians, the Romans, the Mayans, the Habsburgs, even the inhabitants of Easter Island, all died because they were unable to control the appetites of their elites. The elites were able to exploit ecosystems and human beings until these civilizations self-destructed. The quest by a bankrupt elite in a civilization's final days to accumulate greater and greater wealth, as Marx observed, is modern society's version of primitive fetishism. As there is less and less to exploit, this quest leads to mounting repression, increased human suffering, infrastructure collapse, and finally, death. It is the self-deluded on Wall Street and among the political elite, those who entertain and inform us, and those who lack the capacity to question the lusts that will ensure our self-annihilation, who are foolishly held up as exemplars of intelligence, success, and progress. This is the mark of a civilization that has gone insane. The National Alliance on Mental Illness calculates that 1 in 4 adults, approximately 6.5 million Americans, experience mental illness in a given year, which seems a reasonable reaction to the future being constructed for us by our corporate masters. The rich throughout history have found methods and subterfuges to subjugate and resubjugate the working class, and workers have cyclically awoken throughout history to revolt. The Founding Fathers, largely wealthy slaveholders, feared direct democracy and enthusiastically embraced the slaughter of indigenous peoples to seize their land and resources. They rigged our political process to thwart popular rule and protect the property rights of the native aristocracy. The laboring classes were to be kept at bay. The Electoral College, the original power of the states to appoint senators, and the disenfranchisement of women, Native Americans, African Americans, and men without property locked most people out of the democratic process at the beginning of the Republic. We had to fight for our rights and our voice. Hundreds of workers attempting to form unions were killed, and thousands were wounded in our labor wars. Tens of thousands more were fired and blacklisted. The democratic openings we achieved were fought and paid for with the blood of abolitionists, African Americans, suffragists, workers, and anti-war and civil rights activists. Our radical movements, repressed and ruthlessly dismantled in the name of anti-communism, were the real engines of equality and social justice. Now that unions have been broken and sweatshops implanted in the developing world, the squalor and suffering inflicted on workers by the oligarchic class in the 19th century is mirrored in the present. Dissent is once again a criminal act. The Mellons, Rockefellers, and Carnegies at the turn of the last century sought to create a nation of masters and serfs. The modern corporate incarnation of this 19th century oligarchic elite has created a worldwide neo-feudalism under which workers across the planet toil in misery while corporate oligarchs amass hundreds of millions in personal wealth. Rebellion against this global oligarchic elite, however, percolates across the planet. The China Labor Bulletin estimates that there were at least 373 strikes in China from January to June 24, 2014, and 1,171 strikes or worker protests from mid-2011 to 2013. Workers carried out strikes at factories that made products for multinationals such as IBM, Pepsi, Walmart, Nike, and Adidas. In a single strike in April 2014, more than 40,000 workers walked off the job at a factory in Dongguan that produced shoes for Nike and Adidas. The workers went on strike after they discovered that their work contracts were fraudulent and the company had been underpaying the social insurance to which they were legally entitled for at least 2 decades. The monthly minimum wage for these production workers was 1,310 yuan, or $210.27 a month. Nike running shoes cost 1,469 yuan, or $235.79. Class struggle defines most of human history. Marx got this right. The seesaw of history has thrust the oligarchs upward. We sit humiliated and broken on the ground. It is an old battle. It has been fought over and over in human history. The only route left to us, as Aristotle knew, is either submission or revolt.